19. I rode the turbo elevator back up to the observation deck. The moment the elevator doors swished open and I stepped into the large domed room, the odor of burning cannabis filled my nose. The smell grew increasingly stronger the farther I ventured into the room, as did the familiar strains of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, punctuated by fits of only slightly suppressed laughter. In the dim light, I could now make out two figures sprawled out on the floor across the room. Shin and Milo were side by side, lying flat on their backs, staring up through the observation dome at the glowing band of the Milky Way above. They were passing a cruise missile-sized joint back and forth. The Pink Floyd was cranked up so loud they hadn't heard me come in, so I stood there eavesdropping for a few minutes while they continued a giggle-filled discussion of their favorite Robotech episodes. I tiptoed up behind them, then loudly cleared my throat. "What's up, fellas?" Shin scrambled to his feet, looking mortified, but Milo barely even reacted. "Zach," Shin said, turning red. "We didn't hear you come in." He turned to point a finger at his companion. "I was, showing Milo some of the things we grow in our hydroponic garden, and, "Now you're getting stoned out of your gourds," I said, while listening to Dark Side of the Moon. I motioned to the crater's surface out beyond the dome, stretching to the horizon in all directions around us. On the far side of the moon? "This is a special strain of Yoda Kush that I myself created," Shin said, holding up his giant spliff. "I thought it might help relax his nerves." Then he took a long hit and inhaled deeply. "Poor Milo is really stressed out, aren't you?" Milo shook his head. "Not anymore," he said, grinning wide. "Zach, you won't believe this shit." With some effort, he sat up, then turned to face me. "Shin told me that the EDA spent decades engineering a special strain of weed that helps people focus and enhances their ability to play video games. Once they had it perfected, that was when the government finally started legalizing it in the States." He raised his arms in victory. "This ganja is part of the war effort. I love it." He broke into song and Shin immediately joined him. "America, fuck yeah! Coming to save the motherfucking day, yeah!" They broke up into another laughing fit. "Where are the others?" I asked.
"They all snuck off to bone each other," Milo announced. "Wody and Chen slipped away first, then Debbie snuck off with Graham."
I had no idea how to respond to this information.
"I can't say I blame them," Milo said. "We were all facing the possibility of imminent death. Why not throw caution to the wind and go out with a bang?" "So to speak."
"I was just thinking the same thing," Shin said, turning to smile down at him. The two of them made eyes at each other for a few seconds until my clueless ass finally figured out what was going on. As my mother was often fond of pointing out to me, my gaydar was just plain broken. "I'll see you guys later," I said, backing toward the exit. "I'm just gonna, you know," I nodded over my shoulder, "let you guys have some privacy." Shin grinned at me, amused at how flustered I'd become all of a sudden. "Thanks, Zach," he said.
"Yeah, thanks, dude," Milo called after me, laughing. "We could use the privacy."
As I rode the lift down to the Thunderdome, I found myself wondering where Lex was and what she was doing. Had she too found some handsome stranger to spend her last moments with, while I waited mine out, alone up here, a million miles away? 1 hour, 33 minutes, 43 seconds remaining. When I reached the Thunderdome, I didn't think there was anyone else there at first. Then the canopy of one of the drone controller pods slid open, and my father climbed out of it. He smiled at me, but I turned away as soon as our eyes met and walked over to one of the other pods, Just as I was beginning to lower myself into it, my father crouched at the edge of the oval-shaped pit and looked down at me. "I'm sorry, Zach," he said. "I shouldn't have dumped all of that on you. It was too much after everything else you've been through today." "It's okay," I said. "Thanks for listening," he said. "You're a good listener, just like your mom." He looked away. I've been waiting for a long time to talk with you about all that." He trailed off. I lifted my eyes to meet his gaze, but didn't respond. "Aren't you going to say anything?" he asked. I shook my head. "I'm still trying to process all of it," I replied. "I don't know what to believe." He nodded. I hit the button to close my control pod's canopy. It slid shut between us, ending the conversation, or at least postponing it temporarily. I sat in my simulated cockpit with my eyes closed, trying to collect my thoughts. I didn't have much luck. Sometime later, I heard my father greet Debbie, Chen, and Wodey, Milo, Shin, and Graham a few minutes after that. When the countdown clock hit the one-hour mark, we all gathered in front of the command station to watch the President of the United States address the nation from the Oval Office on live television. She smiled reassuringly at the camera, but the fear in her eyes was evident. "My fellow Americans," she began. "At this very moment, the leaders of every nation around the world are about to show their citizens the same briefing film I'm about to show you, which will explain the alarming situation that now faces all of humanity." Debbie was standing nearby, staring down at her QCOM display, waiting for the moment when she could finally call her boys, but our phones were still locked. I glanced over at Chen, Shin, and Graham, who were each focused on other, smaller display screens mounted nearby, the ones that showed the leaders of their respective countries making a similar introduction. A second later, the faces of the U.S. and Chinese presidents and of the Japanese and British prime ministers vanished from the display screens, and the Earth Defense Alliance logo appeared on each of them.
"In 1973, NASA discovered the first evidence of a non-terrestrial intelligence, right here in our very own solar system," Sagan's voiceover began. "When the Pioneer 10 spacecraft sent back the first close-up photograph of Europa, Jupiter's fourth largest moon."
The eight of us stood there, clustered together in a tight knot, and re-watched the entire film, this time with the knowledge that the rest of humanity was seeing it too. When the film ended, the president's face reappeared, and she told the world what Admiral Vance had told all of us at Crystal Palace earlier that morning, which now felt like an entire lifetime ago. Once the president finished revealing the bad news about the approaching alien armada, the networks began replaying her address, with increasingly alarming headlines superimposed across the screen, along with footage showing the stunned and panicked reactions of average people. As I watched the chaos unfold in the array of video windows before me, I thought about my mother and my friends and everyone else trapped down there. Would the EDA's plan really work? Would our civilization collapse in the wake of the revelation that we were about to be invaded by aliens? Or had the EDA subconsciously prepared us enough to deal with it, as they'd hoped? Would humanity cower in fear or stand its ground and fight back? I stared at the screens, wondering which one it would be. Shin pulled up dozens of different television networks from all over the world and displayed them on the dome side by side, along with more video feeds from the internet. We watched as the initial wave of panic spread across the globe, footage of people freaking out on crowded city streets and stampeding out of sports stadiums. But the world seemed to take the news incredibly well. If there were riots, mass suicides, and lootings going on, no one was reporting them, or even posting videos of them online. Within minutes, it seemed like the same newscasters who had delivered the news were now reporting with total confidence that most of the world's civilian population was already responding to the EDA's call to arms, and that hundreds of millions of people all over the world were already mobilizing themselves by logging on to the EDA's online operations servers to enlist and then receive their combat drone assignments and take up arms and defend the planet. Several networks were showing clips of people abandoning their cars in traffic to run into electronics stores and libraries and coffee shops and internet cafes and office buildings, thousands upon thousands of people, all in a mad dash to get somewhere with broadband internet access. There was no way the news networks could have pulled together all that footage so quickly and then edited it together for broadcast. And at this stage, it would be impossible to know whether or not a majority of the world's population was prepared to join the Earth Defense Alliance and fight to defend our home. This had to be the EDA at work, convincing media outlets that our best chance at survival was to tell the reassuring lie. And they were right. If people believed that humanity was already uniting itself under the EDA's banner, they were far more likely to join the fight themselves. I thought again of the note my father had scribbled in his notebook so long ago. What if they're using video games to train us to fight without us even knowing it? Like Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid when he made Daniel-san paint his house, sand his deck, and wax all of his cars. He was training him and he didn't even realize it. Wax on, wax off, but on a global scale. 30 and 60 second long public service announcements began to run amid the news bulletins, each designed to inform the world's civilian population of the EDA's plan and show them how to use their computer or mobile device to enlist in the Earth Defense Alliance online and help save the world. The best PSA was one that opened with a shot of a brother and sister sitting on the couch in their living room. The boy is playing Armada on their giant television, while the girl sits beside him playing Terra Firma on her handheld tablet. On their screens, we can see that she's operating an Aethid infantry drone, while he pilots a Wasp quadcopter. Both of them are trying to take down a towering alien basilisk stomping its way through a suburban neighborhood. On the TV screen, we see the behemoth lurch forward and step onto the corner of a house, crushing it under one of its massive metal feet. And at that same moment, the wall of the kid's living room also collapses, revealing that it was their house the giant robot just stepped on. The two kids aren't playing a game. They're defending their home. Their parents cower behind the couch, watching as their two children do battle with the giant alien machine with the help of hundreds of other drones operated by their neighbors. When the behemoth explodes under a hail of enemy fire, the parents whip out their smartphones and use them to take control of two more drones and join the battle too. It reminded me of one of those old toy commercials that ended with the line, "And Mom and Dad can play along too." When I couldn't bear to watch the news feeds any longer, I climbed into my control pod and closed the canopy, then made it non-transparent, creating my own private isolation chamber. I sat there in the darkness for a while, listening to myself breathe. Then I took out my Q-com and queued up a song I'd first discovered on one of my father's old mixtapes. It was a great rock instrumental by Pink Floyd that I'd often used to psych myself up before a big Armada mission. I'd played it over and over, each time mouthing the words to the single lyric spoken in the middle of the song. "One of these days, I'm going to cut you into little pieces." 1 hour, 0 minutes, 0 seconds remaining. When the countdown clock showed only 1 hour remaining, all of our Q-coms beeped in unison. A notice on my display told me that the EDA had finally unlocked our Q-coms' access to the public phone system. Graham, Debbie, Wodey, Milo, and Chen each climbed into their individual drone controller pods and then closed their canopies to give themselves some privacy for their calls home. Shin didn't call anyone. Instead, he picked up his bass guitar and, in what seemed like an odd coincidence, he began to play a solo version of One of These Days while staring up at the stars projected on the dome over our heads. Then, I noticed a practice set list taped to the floor in front of him, and saw that several of the songs listed there were tracks I knew from my father's old mixtapes. My father was off by himself, too, sitting at the command center console. When I walked over to join him, I saw that he was staring at my mother's contact information on his QCOM's display screen. "Are you going to call her?" I asked, making him jump slightly. He shook his head. "I was about to send her a video message instead," he said. "I recorded 23 takes of it, but they're all terrible, so maybe I'll just give up and send her the least terrible one." I plucked the QCOM out of his hand and began to dial a number. "Are you going to call her?" he asked, like a nervous schoolboy. "Right now?" I nodded. "I need to let her know I'm okay," I said. "And before you send her some psychotic video message, I should probably break the news to her that you're alive first. Otherwise, she'll have a coronary when your face pops up on her iPhone." My father gave me a relieved smile, but before he could reply, we were interrupted by Milo's voice coming from his nearby pod. When he'd climbed inside, he must have forgotten to close his canopy all the way, and now we could hear every word of his conversation.
"Ma, it's gonna be okay," Milo said. "You know how they've been training everyone to fight with video games? Well, I'm one of the best Armada pilots in the world, and so that's why they recruited me early. Yeah, and guess what? I'm stationed up here on the moon."
"The moon?" she cried. "That's ridiculous, Milo. Don't you lie to your mother."
She raised a giant TV remote.
"I need your help with this blasted TV. The same nonsense is on every channel."
I glanced over and saw Milo raise his QCOM's camera, then tilt it to give her a quick look at the Thunderdome and at the dazzling field of stars projected on its dome ceiling. She gasped, and Milo grinned, lowering the QCOM's camera and aiming it back at his own face.
"Told ya," he said.
His mother started to wail in fear. There was no other word for it.
"They put you in charge of defending us? Now I know we're doomed."
"Ma, please," Milo said, sounding more and more like a little boy with each word. "Relax. I'm gonna stop these things, I promise."
"Don't worry. I'll do whatever it takes to keep you and little Kilgore from getting hurt. You're gonna be proud of me when this is all done. You wait and see."
I didn't get to find out who or what Kilgore was, because my father walked over and closed Milo's pod canopy for him. Then he walked back over and watched nervously as I raised his QCOM and placed the video call to my mother. A second later, my mother's drawn and worried face appeared on the QCOM's display. She was at work, of course, standing in one of the hospital's rooms, clustered in front of a TV with a dozen other nurses. Even now, after the announcement, she still hadn't abandoned the people she cared for.
"Zach!"
my mother shouted the moment she saw my face. She rushed out into the empty hospital corridor, holding her phone up in front of her.
"Thank God you're okay, honey. You are okay, aren't you?"
"I'm fine, Mom," I said. "You know, aside from the impending alien invasion."
"Can you believe it?" she said. "It's all over the news, every channel."
She held the phone directly in front of her face.
"Where are you? I want you to get home, Zachary, right this minute."
"I can't, Mom," I said. "The Earth Defense Alliance needs me."
"What are you talking about?"
she said, sounding increasingly hysterical. "I enlisted," I told her.
"In the Earth Defense Alliance, this morning. They made me a flight officer, see?"
I set the phone down on the console in front of me, then stepped back so she could see my uniform. The sight appeared to leave her speechless.
"Honey, where are you?" she finally managed to ask.
"I'm on the moon," I said, panning the QCOM's camera around the room and then up at the dome above. "Moonbase Alpha. It's a secret base on the far side. I'm going to help fight off the invasion from up here." I gave her a smile. "All those years I spent playing video games weren't wasted after all, eh?" She broke down into tears then, but she still managed to sound incredibly pissed off.
"Zachary Ulysses Lightman," she shouted, making the phone tremble fiercely in her hands. "You are not fighting any goddamn aliens. You come home right this minute."
"Mom, it's going to be okay," I said as soothingly as I could.
I'm not alone up here, okay? That's the other thing I have to tell you. It's gonna be a shock, so brace yourself.
I pulled my father in front of the QCOM's camera, then stood just behind him. His legs were shaking so badly I worried he might collapse.
Oh my God,
my mother said, covering her mouth.
Xavier? Is that you?
Hello, Pam, he said, his voice shaking. It's
really good to see you.
It can't be you, I heard my mother say.
It can't be!
It's really him, Mom, I said. He's a general in the Earth Defense Alliance, a war hero. I smiled at him. He's been awarded 3 Medals of Honor, haven't you? He didn't say anything. He just stared at her like a deer in the headlights.
Xavier? She said. It's really you?
It's really...
It's really me,
he said, his voice breaking after each word.
I'm alive, and I'm so sorry. I can't tell you how much I've missed you, and how sorry I am for leaving you to raise our son all on your own. I'm sorry for a lot of other things, too, but...
She started crying again. My father's face contorted in pain, and that was when I turned and walked away, well out of earshot, to let them talk in private, and to avoid a crying jag of my own. I glanced around the room and saw Shin talking quietly with Milo. Nearby, Graham and Debbie were doing the same thing. Wody and Chen were both squeezed into Chen's pod, seizing their last chance to make out. I climbed into my own control pod and lowered the canopy. Then I took out my QCOM and closed my eyes, thinking about what I was going to say to Lex. I tapped her name on my very short contact list, and her face appeared on my display so quickly that it startled me. Her name, rank, and current location appeared in the bottom right-hand corner of my display. According to the readout, she'd already somehow managed to get herself promoted to captain, and she was still located at Sapphire Station, the EDA operations stronghold near Billings, Montana. She was sitting inside a darkened control pod similar to mine, except that hers appeared to be designed specifically to control Sentinels, Titan War Mechs, and Aethids, and included a pair of power gauntlets that let her control the drone's massive hands with her own.
Hey, you!
I was hoping I'd get to see your face again before the world ended. I considered putting it off until the weekend. I didn't want to seem too eager. No, of course not, she smirked. So, what's it like up on the moon, Lieutenant? Are we being honest? Why not, she said. We probably won't live to regret anything we say. It's pretty terrifying up here, actually. How are things down there?
Equally insane, she said. But civilization hasn't descended into total chaos yet. People seem to be holding it together. If the news is to be believed, it seems like the whole world is ready to fight back. It's kind of amazing.
It was hard to hear so much hope in her voice and not be able to tell her about the second icebreaker or my father's theory. I desperately wanted to hear what she thought, but there was no time.
You ready to give these aliens what for, Lieutenant? She asked.
As ready as I'll ever be, Lieutenant. Excuse me, Captain Larkin.
I gave her another salute. Then, like a goofball, I pretended to poke myself in the eye as I did, just to hear the sound of her laugh.
How'd you get promoted so fast? I asked.
For heroism in the Battle of Crystal Palace, she said. And I had the high score on the ground as far as enemy drones downed. Plus, I didn't blow up half the installation.
Yeah, they frown on that.
Here, I'm sending you a present, she said, tapping at her QCOM display with both thumbs. A playlist of my favorite Terra Firma battle tunes. I like to rock out when I'm knocking clocks out, she said. Helps with my aim.
Yeah, I said, smiling. Mine too.
A file transfer complete message popped up on my QCOM a split second later,
She'd somehow bypassed the security software, so it didn't even ask me for permission before it transferred the songs onto my device. The music player opened, displaying her playlist, which, at first glance, appeared to be a mix of songs by only Joan Jett, Hart, and Pat Benatar. "This should come in handy," I said, grinning. "Gracias."
"De nada."
I asked her to show me how to do the file transfer trick myself. When she was done, I managed to successfully send her a copy of my father's Raid the Arcade mix. She scrolled through the track list for a few seconds, smiling and nodding. "Hey, want to hear some good news?" she asked. "Yes, please," I said, "more than I probably ever have in my life." "I think I'm going to be assigned to help defend Moonbase Alpha from down here," she said. "You know, provided they don't attack Earth first. We've been running NBA defense sims nonstop since I arrived." I smiled, something I wouldn't have thought possible a few seconds earlier. "So you're going to have my back, eh?" she nodded. "Just give me the QCOM ID number on your drone controller station," she said. "I figured out a hack that will allow me to use it to pinpoint your location and tell me which drone you're operating during combat."
"When did you have time to do that?"
"I've been sitting here all day exploring the QCOM network between training sims," she said. "The EDA set it up a lot like a traditional computer network, which made it really easy to figure out and use. That's probably why they did it that way. So, what's your QCLID?"
"My what?"
"Your Quantum Communicator Link Identification Number?" I stared at the icons that ringed the edge of my display screen and shrugged. "I have no idea." She grinned at me and rolled her eyes. "See that gear icon at the top right of your display? Those are your drone controller station settings."
"Right," I said, tapping it with my finger. "I knew that."
She helped me navigate through menu screens until I located the 12-digit long numeric code she needed and read it off to her.
"Got it," she said as her fingers danced across one of the touch screens in front of her. "Now I can keep an eye on you."
"I feel much better now," I said. And I did, too.
"You should," she said. "I've got the skills to pay the bills." She winked at me, all smooth like a movie star.
"And I'm going to make sure you keep all of your pieces in one piece," she said.
"Until I get a piece. Get me, soldier?"
"Yes, ma'am," I said. "I believe I do." Then I saluted, and it made her laugh. But a few seconds in, it somehow turned into a strangled sob.
"Fuck, I'm scared, Zach," she said.
She bit her lower lip to stop it from trembling, I think.
"I'm scared too," I said, suddenly unable to meet her eyes, even through a screen. "My whole life I always imagined fighting off an alien invasion would be some epic adventure, that it would be like the movies. Humanity would triumph in the end."
"Invasion of the Body Snatchers," she said. "The pod people always win. That's the smart way to invade, not this Independence Day Pacific Rim job crap." Her words brought me back to my conversation with my father, and the doubt he'd managed to instill in me during the course of it. Was he right? Would the icebreaker save humanity, or only seal our doom?
"I don't want to die for nothing, Zach," Lex said, looking determined now. "Do you think there's a chance we can stop them? All of them? That humans can survive this?"
I nodded my head way too enthusiastically. "Yes," I answered, way too quickly. "We have to." I stopped my head from nodding. "Do or do not. There is no try and all that stuff." She laughed and gave me a smile.
"I'm really glad we met, Zach," she said.
She was twisting her fingers into knots in her lap.
"I just wish..."
"Me too, Lex." She took a deep breath.
"I must not fear," she recited. "Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration."
I laughed and picked up the quote where she left off. "I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path," she continued. "Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain." She exhaled slowly. Then we shared a smile. "If the world doesn't end tonight and we're both still alive tomorrow, then I'm taking you out on a date," she said. "Deal?"
"Deal." 0 hours, 14 minutes, 49 seconds remaining. My father finished his preparations at the command center and climbed down into his own drone controller pod, which was adjacent to mine. Then the eight of us sat there, each alone in our stations, watching the last 15 minutes elapse on the countdown clock. The general still looked as if he was trying to recover from the emotional strain of speaking with my mom. I didn't want to ask him what he and my mother had talked about, but I still wanted to say something to him, to try to make peace while there was still time. I climbed out of my pod and grabbed my EDA backpack, which was resting nearby on the floor. My father's old jacket was still stuffed inside, and I pulled it out and handed it to him. When my father saw the jacket, he grinned wide and spent a minute looking over each and every patch. When he was finished, he leaned over and hugged me. "Thank you," he said. "But how is it possible that you have this with you?" "I was wearing it this morning when they came to recruit me," he laughed. "Seriously?" I nodded. He flipped the jacket around and put it on. "Still fits," he said, admiring the patches running down each of its sleeves. "I used to wear this when I would hit the local arcades. I thought it brought me good luck," he laughed. "I also thought it made me look like a badass," he shook his head. "Your old man was kind of a dork." He took the jacket off and tried to hand it back to me. "I bet it looks a lot better on you," he said. "Let me see." I shook my head. "No way. You earned all those patches. You should wear it." He nodded and slipped it back on. "Thank you, Zach. Don't mention it." By the time I walked back over to my own pod, there were only 5 minutes remaining on the clock. And then 4 minutes. Then 3, 2, 1. I dropped down into my pilot seat and the pod's canopy slid closed above me. "All things are ready, if our minds be so," I heard Wodey whisper over the comm. Just then my QCOM made its wireless link to the pod's surround sound system, and the next track on my Raid the Arcade playlist began to blare out of its speakers, "Rock You Like a Hurricane" by the Scorpions. I bobbed my head in time with its opening machine gun guitar riff as the last few seconds on the countdown clock ticked away. When it finally hit zero, a klaxon began to wail, and a red alert indicator began to flash on my HUD. My tactical display lit up, informing me that our remote sensors had just detected the first sign of the Europan Vanguard emerging from the asteroid belt out beyond the orbit of Mars. They were really hauling ass. The dreadnought sphere in the lead was already closing in on the red planet, surrounded on all sides by a phalanx of glaives. "Here they come!" Milo cried over the comlink. "They're coming! See them?"
"Yes, Milo," Debbie replied. "Our eyes work too. We see them."
"There's a lot of them," Wodey added. "An awful lot."
"The ones we don't stop will be knocking on our front door in a few minutes, so take out as many as you can before they get here," my father ordered over the comlink. "Your drone assignments are linked and locked. Pilots, prepare to launch."
"Wolverines!" Milo shouted.
Then he let out a long, whooping war cry into his comlink, which somehow mixed in perfectly with the war cry the Scorpions were already blasting into my eardrums. On my display, the distance between Earth and the approaching enemy vanguard continued to shrink rapidly, and I could feel my pulse begin to rise. "Stay frosty, everyone," my father said, "and may the Force be with you."
"May the Force be with us," Shin repeated, with no hint of irony in his voice.
"May the Force be with us," Graham echoed over the comlink. Debbie and Milo each echoed the sentiment, followed by Chen, who said it in Mandarin.
"Zhuan Li Yu, Ni Tong Zai."
The sincerity in Chen's voice finally convinced me to join in. I keyed my mic and carefully repeated after him.
"Zhuan Li Yu, Ni Tong Zai."
Chen laughed and said something else. The somewhat imperfect English translation popped up on my HUD. "We are coming here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and we have no more bubblegum." I laughed out loud, and for several more seconds, I couldn't stop laughing.
I'd only just learned the term gallows humor a few months earlier from a book we'd been assigned in American literature about the Civil War. At the time, it wasn't a type of humor I thought I would ever be in a position to experience, but now, as hearing Chen belt out Roddy Piper's battle cry from They Live in Chinese struck me as one of the funniest things I'd ever heard in my life, I understood the concept perfectly. All drones cleared for launch, the general announced. Let's go get 'em. The eight of us launched our interceptors, joining the steady stream of drones already pouring out of the hangar under the control of pilots located back on Earth. Together, we flew out to meet the alien invaders.